Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. Open your mind to a new way of living. timberliving.ie.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show, and indeed a lot of the front pages this morning are leading with the death of the businessman Ben Dunn. The Mirror goes with simply Ben Dunn dies age 74, supermarket tycoon suffers heart attack on holiday in Dubai. The Sun, Dunn dies on Dubai holiday. There's a picture of him on the front of the Sunday Independent, but their lead is a horrible story. A psychiatrist in court accused of raping girl, and that is a HSE psychiatrist who is attached to the CAMS and has been accused of awful things. The Sunday Times the top of its front page is rugby stars sue over brain injuries, right? So David Walsh has this story. Players, including four former Ireland internationals who have not been named, are among 294 who say they've been left with illnesses, including dementia and depression, because of repeated blows to the head suffered on the field and in training. So they're bringing a case against World Rugby, the Rugby Football Union in England, and the Welsh Rugby Union. The Business Post is leading with enhanced golden handshakes for RTE staff earning over 100k. So according to this, people who take voluntary redundancy will walk away potentially with 2 years pay if they've been in RTE for more than 10 years. The Mail, revenue to collect licence fees. So they're saying direct funding or broadcast charge too risky. That's according to their cabinet sources. Now, according to the Sunday Independent, they are saying that the minister herself favours direct exchequer funding. And the Sunday World, gun down the front door. And this is the first gangland murder of 2023 in Finglas. You will have heard about that on various news bulletins. Now, our panel today, Brenda Power, is a columnist at the Irish Daily Mail and the Sunday Times. Johnny Fallon is strategy director at Carr Communications. Colm O'Gorman is a human rights campaigner. And Rena Maycock is chief executive of, is that Kilter or Silter?
Kilter Hertzie.
Which is child protection software, but she is also a former chief executive of iRadio. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Now, we'll put on your headphones first. And we'll talk a bit about Ben Dunn. I suppose one of the things that did endear Ben Dunn to people at the time of his misadventures in Florida was he came home and put his hands up straight away. That was in 1992. He'd been arrested for cocaine possession and soliciting. But he came back, put his hands up and said, I have no one to blame but myself. Sunday Independent reporter Liam Collins, good morning.
Good morning, Brendan.
Do you remember where you were when you got the call to meet Ben that week?
I do. I was sitting up in our rather tawdry offices of the Sunday Independent in Middle Abbey Street. And I had put out a feeler to somebody I knew who was very close to Ben Dunn and was told to expect a call. And the call came, much to my surprise. And I was told to go downstairs and at the front door, there would be a black Mercedes, and to open the door and sit into the back, which I did. And the other person sitting in the back was Ben Dunn.
Okay. So,
and we talked maybe for an hour about his misadventures, as you call them. The story had broken the previous Sunday in the Sunday Tribune, and it had caused an absolute sensation in Ireland. You know, this is 40 years ago when hookers and drugs were a little bit stranger than they might be today.
Yeah, and I don't think we call them hookers anymore, Liam, either. Back then, though, that would have been the phraseology.
That was the terminology.
And just for people too young to remember 40 years ago, what happened exactly and why was it such a big story?
Well, it was such a big story because he was on a golfing trip. This is in 1992. He had an entourage of about 15 people. They booked into the Hyatt in Orlando, which was one of the fanciest hotels in the city. And Ben then proceeded to go on a cocaine binge, and he rang a girl, Denise Wojak, who worked for escorts in a flash, and she was in the room. He then appeared to have, well, he did have a psychotic episode, and she called security, and when they appeared, he threatened to jump from in the atrium, which I think was 19 stories up, and took a lot of he was a big man, so it took a lot to restrain him, and he was charged then with, as you say, possession of cocaine.
And Liam, I suppose we'd understand more now maybe about Ben's problems and vulnerabilities and everything, but I suppose to understand fully his mental health issues there and that incident, we'd go back a decade earlier.
Yes.
To when Ben was kidnapped by the IRA.
Yeah, that was 1981. He was kidnapped by the IRA. He was held somewhere around the border for about 10 days. He obviously suffered a lot of trauma at the time. And we don't know for certain whether ransom was paid, but it was because it was against government policy, and the police were trying to stop it. But it is believed a ransom of some sort was paid. He was released, and he told me he literally went back to work. I mean, in those days, 1981, there was no such thing as counselling. There was no such thing as let's, you know, take it, go away and try and get some help. He went literally straight back into work, and it certainly seems to have been part of the mental issues he had, and the cocaine obviously triggered some memory that of what happened.
And did that? It's interesting that he went back into work straight away. Just tell us a bit about the family and the empire and Ben's father. And Ben would have been put to work from an early age, and all the family were involved in what became an extraordinary business empire.
Yeah, they started, as you know, in Patrick Street in Cork. And yes, all of the family went into the business when they were very young. They spent their summers stacking shelves, doing all the things that people do, you know, the tasks that need to be done. And then Ben and his wife, Nora, and their eldest son, Frank, discovered Cornell's Court, a huge disused building in South County Dublin, Cabinteely.
This is Ben Senior, you mean now?
That's Ben Senior, yeah. Exactly. And they more or less moved. No, they didn't more or less. They moved to Dublin. They stayed in, they lived in the Jury's Hotel, which was then in College Green, and later in the Shelburne Hotel. And as the others, Ben Junior then left school at 16. He'd had enough of education. He wanted to get his hands dirty in business, and he joined the family firm. And within a decade, he had kind of taken control of, he was chairman and chief executive of the business. He had three sisters, Margaret, the eldest, who was involved. The other two sisters were not. And Frank, who was the eldest and was joint chairman, didn't really take an interest in the business. He was more interested in training horses, and he did train some very good horses in his time.
But and then back to the Florida incident. It was the aftermath of that Florida incident led to Ben leaving the empire and ultimately to a series of enormous political scandals.
Yeah, the fallout was quite enormous, because when himself and his sister Margaret, they really fell out very badly. I mean, in one incident, it's detailed that she was having a meeting with suppliers, and he stormed into the room and put a cigarette out in her Perrier water and said, "You're not going to get me out of the business that easily." So he then taunted her that he had given £1 million to Charlie Haughey over the years, and that she would never find the evidence. And she did find the evidence, and they turned up in court papers that led to the McCracken Tribunal. It led to, and the report of McCracken, in which he detailed payments to Mr. Haughey, also led to Michael Lowry, the Fine Gael minister, who was a supplier to Dunn Stores, losing his job as a Fine Gael minister. And okay. then the tribunals took over from there.
Okay, okay. And look, I mean, I suppose we should, you might stay with us, Liam, I'll bring in the panel, but I suppose we should reflect too that Ben kind of recovered from all that and went on to have the gyms, and I think probably did find some kind of a peace later in life, and also himself and Margaret had reconciled, and I think they were very fond of each other again.
That's right. And one of his great obsessions was playing golf. And I'm told by people who were involved in that area, he was so generous. He played out in Portmarnock, but young professionals, he would give them, stake them money, or he would bet against them in the hope that he'd lose and be able to give them money in a very generous. No, he was a very generous, larger than life personality, as anyone will know from hearing his ads. Mm. And he just he loved kind of life, as you've described some of it today. He loved the high living as well. He certainly put money around the place.
Yeah. Brenda, you kind of think in a way that if anyone else had had the kind of checkered history Ben Dunn had had, that people wouldn't be that fond of him. But people liked Ben, didn't they?
They really did. And I saw a great quote from him someplace today to the effect that money is like manure. It's no good unless you spread it around. And that did seem to have been his kind of mantra. But I think, Brendan, a lot of that affection for him came from his candour immediately after the Florida episode, because he did something which is pretty much remains unprecedented in Irish political and social engagement. He came out with his hands up and said, "Ask me what you want. Here is what happened."
Yeah. Didn't
blame anybody except himself. But it is still held up as sort of the masterclass in how to handle bad news. And I mean, we've seen lots of people over the last whatever 30 odd years who could have followed Ben's advice, because, you know, get to your own end position first, put it out there first, and then take the flak, because it is going to come out, and the details of that were going to come out. And it's actually, I don't know if it's something you remember yourself, Brendan, but it was a classic journalistic scoop. I think it was Rory Godson was on the news desk in the Sunday Tribune that week, took a call from a stringer in Florida who said, there's an Irish businessman been arrested here. Yeah. Would you be interested in him? He's going, I don't know, what's his name? Ben Dunn, and he was on the next plane.
But
I mean,
what
he did was unprecedented at the time, and I think has rarely been followed since. And that is, I think, the basis for a lot of the affection that he was held in.
So in a way, at a man's kind of lowest point, in a way, is the ultimate test of character. And Ben passed that test as far as Irish people were concerned, Johnny.
He did, yeah. And I think, you know, the other thing that I think always stood with him over the years, and I didn't know him, I met him once at a funeral because PJ Mara at the time introduced me to him, and like that larger than life character. Now I know everybody seems big to me, but he was a huge man. But again, took those few moments, talked to you, what are you doing, what are you involved in, what areas are you involved in, always had time for people. But I'd also say his loyalty, that's what everybody that I know who knew Ben Dunn would come back and they'd say, Ben is loyal. You know, Ben sticks by you. Ben doesn't walk out when the going gets tough and goes. And I think that was part of it. He was loyal to a fault, literally, in where some of the money went and some of the things. You can't take away from the fact that it was wrong to do what he did with the money and Haughey and all that. But he saw all that as this idea that it was, you know, well, I have it and now I'm going to share it round, and if someone needs help, I give it to them, irrespective of what the outcome of that was. But he did stick around. So I think it's a combination of all the people who met him and knew him, and in journalistic circles, political circles, they also felt loyalty goes a long way. When they feel somebody sticks around through thick and thin, and they felt that they owed him that loyalty back to a degree, even though, you know, times were tough for a lot of it. But I think when he came out of that and he set up the new business, it was just always refreshing to hear Ben Dunn come on and be a straight talker. He wasn't kind of over rehearsed on things, and he called it as it is or as he saw it. He wasn't afraid to say things. He didn't shy away from it. Now, I will say all of that goes with the fact that he was always quite comfortable in life and he wasn't rebuilding himself just from scratch every time losing everything. Yeah. But, you know, it was a core part to him.
Rena, you knew him a bit?
I did. I sold him advertising on a couple of occasions back in the early noughties when his rep was on Mat Leaf. And what surprised me...
I'd say he was a tough customer to sell an ad to, was he?
He'll beat you down on price. I mean, he gets the best deal on every radio station. So I remember going out to him to meet him, and he was already advertising on 98FM that I was working there at the time. And he sat me down. Usually these calls take about half an hour. I was there for about 2 hours. And he opened up his heart to me and told me all about his woes. I knew very little about him. I was only in my early 20s. I wasn't reading the newspapers at the time. So he laid it all out bare. I just staggered at how honest he was back then. I came out a bit shell-shocked. But even since then, you know, he was always on the end of a phone for me. I didn't ring him very often, but I would ring him sometimes if I had a business question or something like that. And he would always answer it. Yeah. I wouldn't go as far as to say mentor or anything like that, but he would always pick up the phone if you called him.
Call him.
Yeah, I never met him at all. A tough day, of course, for his family, particularly today. The loss of a family member is always enormous, but the loss of somebody with the size of personality and the history and the story of Ben. I mean, imagine that being your dad. I mean, that's an extraordinary loss to lose in your life. So my sympathy to them. I was living in London when the scandals emerged in 1992. And that's the one thing that strikes me. If you think about the impact that his life had on Irish life, right, through the engagements they had within the political system. Like from 1992 that emerged, 2011 you had the Moriarty Tribunal reports coming out, Bertie Ahern resigning ultimately as Taoiseach in 2008, again off the back of those kind of revelations. The impact that his story and his behaviour and his conduct and his engagement with the political system had on Irish society has been extraordinary and very, very long term. I think perhaps the most admirable thing about the man is not how he rebuilt his business, perhaps. That's always impressive, of course, but rather how he seems to have rebuilt his personhood, right? I mean, to go through what he went through. I would agree absolutely, Brendan. I can only imagine the trauma of that kidnap experience on him. And I'm not surprised, given that the day after he was released, he was back in work, that at some future point in his life, he found himself at a point of absolute collapse. That's almost inevitable. But the fact that he was able to rebuild his person and to live in the world that he did, is a testament to the man and to who he was. But, you know, the impact that he and the engagements he had on others, on Ireland, on its political system is extraordinary. I mean, Moriarty said in 2011 that his dealings with Michael Lowry, what was contemplated and attempted on the part of Mr. Dunn and Mr. Lowry was profoundly corrupt to a degree that was nothing short of breathtaking.
Okay. And look, there'll be plenty going over all that. But Liam, I suppose there's that legacy. Is there also a legacy that, like, I don't know, probably like an older generation than me would say that Ben Dunn and the Dunn stores he created kind of clothed and fed the nation in a kind of a very democratic way that was we didn't have all the outlets we have now and everything. Are you gone, Liam?
No, I'm here, Brendan. Yeah, there was a Dunn Stores in nearly every town, and old Ben's philosophy was the cost cutters, you know, pile them high and sell them cheap. And where he really made his money was that he got 60 days credit, and so he didn't have to pay for anything. He had the money in the bank. There were high interest rates. So absolutely, Dunn Stores, and Ben himself believed in that philosophy. When he was ousted from the business, Margaret Heffernan changed it quite dramatically and brought it up market and designer labels. But yeah, back in the 70s and 80s, Dunn Stores was the place most families bought their clothes because that was all they could afford.
Yeah, yeah. And look, a great salesman too. And actually, so if people can cast their minds back, right, to early 2021, it's a very dark period in the country and everything. And Ben came on with us one day and talked for about 15 minutes, kind of homespun philosophy on life and advice on how people might get through things and everything. And I remember at the time, people were so, they were very taken by him. And they were like, who knew Ben Dunn like has this receptacle of wisdom? But he did. I'm just going to play a short little clip from it here.
I think that we're after getting ourselves, some of us have got ourselves into a state of mind. We have an old saying in this country, the light at the end of the tunnel. And in some cases, or maybe in a lot of cases, that light at the end of the tunnel appears to be going further away. And we're not used to that. Nobody is used to that. And it is not the case that the light is going further away if you apply the right thinking.
Yeah. Now, Ben, in fairness, I think it did start getting to you at one point, didn't it?
Oh, very much so. I found it very hard to motivate myself. I found it hard. I lost my appetite. I found it hard to show much interest in anything. Funnily enough, I'd be a Christian more than anything else, but I had a little prayer that I used to say every day, and that helped me. It motivated me just that little bit, just to get me moving forward.
What's the little prayer?
It went very simple, and I say it every day. So far, all my nights have been followed by more days. But in this world of mine, a night will come when there will be no more day for me. Lord, look after me today.
There's Ben, and again, the trademark honesty and candor as well, though, you know, but that spiritual dimension, because by God, he'd been on some journey in life, hadn't he? Liam, you'll identify with a text here. 30 years ago, I used to serve Ben as a lounge boy in a pub. He was so generous, he'd tip you the change out of a £20 note for 1 pint. And that was him, wasn't it?
Oh, incredible. A quick story. He broke his legs and he was in the Mater private. Went in for when he was recovering on crutches, he went in for a drink in Birmingham's, a working man's pub up in Dorset Street. He complained to the owner about the carpets, and the owner said, listen, this is an ordinary, decent place, Ben. It's not for the likes of you. The following morning, Kelly's carpet people arrived and carpeted the entire downstairs. He went in and had one more pint, and they never saw him again.
Okay, that's as good a note to leave it as any. Liam Collins, thank you very much for that. And our panel staying with us, we'll take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Would you believe we're still sitting here talking about Duns and discussing the Duns these days and the Duns there, and what's the Duns like in Dundrum and the new one, the big Duns in Bishopstown is known, big Duns and small Duns where I come from. Now, our panel still with us, Brenda Power, Johnny Fallon, Colm O'Gorman, Rena Maycock, and we will get back to the present, I suppose. Brenda, will we start on the RTE stuff? The interview in the Sunday Times today, Ryan Tuberty interviewed by Jennifer Stevens. I'm playing senior hurling now. You picked this out.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it does sound as though this may well turn out to be the making of Ryan Tuberty, at least a whole new chapter in his life. We're talking earlier about how Ben Dunn reinvented himself after a rough time, and it seems the potential is certainly there for Ryan to do the same. I saw his interview with Chris Evans last week, and he said when he was announcing his new job in Virgin, and he described how Sinead O'Connor had reached out to him during his difficulties and said, you know, this may turn out to be a mugging by God in a hoodie. In other words, you'll turn around someday and you'll say, actually, that was a blessing in disguise. And he's going to be addressing an audience of, I think, 2 million. Now, I know Virgin isn't the biggest player in London, but there is
definitely... Yeah, I don't even know if it's 2 million. Yeah.
I saw some suggestion that the audience he will inherit from Chris Evans in mid-morning could be 1.5 to 2 million. Not entirely sure what it is. But in any event, he's an unknown quantity, pretty much, in the UK. So he has a clear ballpark to reinvent himself. And there is kind of a Terry Wogan, which is a Henry Kelly shaped hole in British broadcasting at the moment. It's not filled by Graham Norton, who has a very distinctive style. So I could see this working out very well for him. But certainly it does seem to be, I suppose, one in the eye for his detractors here. So good luck to him, I'd say.
Johnny, you picked that interview as well?
Yeah, I think it was just an interesting interview to hear, because I think, look, on a personal level, you have to wish everybody well in their you know, he's been through a tough time. It is, whether people agree with him, disagree with him, anything else, it's never nice to be in the eye of any storm. And when you are, you know, it is tough. And it was a life-changing situation for him. So, you know, this is a great opportunity to go away. And I think he needed to go. I think he needed to go to the UK. I don't think it was possible to rebuild. I think he made some grave mistakes in how he handled, you know, relations with RTE, and I think he made some grave mistakes. You know, his approach to the Oireachtas Committee was to get out of there without getting any too bad a hit, rather than approaching it with, I need a platform to build on. And that's the thing many people mistake when they go into Oireachtas Committees. And as a result, he came out of that not really having a kind of a sense of who is Ryan Tubridy, the interviewer, because he had moved over the years in Ireland away from just light entertainment. This wasn't, he came across in the committee as a guy who could be a good comedian, you know, but could he be the hard-nosed interviewer? No, because he didn't give himself the gravitas within that committee. He started to say this kind of thing of, well, the money, I know nothing about money, guys. I'm just a really nice guy. And I leave all the money over to these nasty people around me who'll sort it out. That's not strong enough if you want to be a serious investigative interviewer and someone who deals with really important issues.
Do you think, does he bear any responsibility, like a partial part of a collective responsibility for everything that's happening in RTE right now? I mean, with 400 jobs going.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's no way around that. And it's always been that way. I mean, he is not the fault of it. He's not, nor even the biggest fault of it. But he was always the biggest earner. And he was always known as the biggest earner in a time when recessions have hit, financial crisis have hit. We've had all of these things coming one after the other. And he was always a lightning rod for that because he was the biggest earner. An inability to see why that might be the case and an inability to empathise with a public meant that you get a public who now are really annoyed about licence fees and going, do you know what, we're just not paying them because we're fed up with the salaries. He may walk away from that, and but he will find he's going now into another world where it will be commercially driven. If he gets the results, he gets the salary. If he doesn't, it's going to be a bigger challenge. But there is a responsibility there, I think, that goes with it. He's not solely to blame, but you can't walk away as having been the biggest earner and say, well, it was nothing to do with me, or I bear no responsibility for the way
people
treat
it. But it wasn't just that he was the biggest earner. Was it not the fashion in which he was...
It was the fashion in which he dealt with it, and the way his... We're talking about Ben Dunn's response. I think his response was...
That he was one who could have benefited from emulating Ben Dunn's approach, come out day one and say, look, here's the story, here's the situation, this is what happened.
He would argue that he did come out and tell his side of the story all the time. Okay, yeah. Colm.
It strikes me that when we talk about big earners, he might look back on that period and think, well, actually, I took over the Late Late Show and the radio show at a time where I was earning half of what my predecessor did. So I think at one point, Pat Kenny was earning near or north
up
of a million a year,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, which is extraordinary, right? I mean, it's the figures involved in a market the size of ours are just extraordinary by any scale of the imagination, whether it's the million figure or the half million year, they are extraordinary.
Compared
but it might speak to as to why he thinks he did his bit in that context. It doesn't make any sense, of course, rationally. On his capacity to be an interviewer of significance, I remember doing an interview with Ryan on his radio show when I had my memoir out back in about 2008, I think it was, and this was a fairly sensitive interview, and I was warned before I went in by one of his producers that Ryan wasn't great with anything that was too icky and he might find this a little bit difficult. It was one of the best interviews I did anywhere in the world when that book came out. He asked questions with a level of sensitivity that was extraordinary, but also questions that nobody else would dare ask. It was quite an exceptional interview.
Johnny, in fairness, was saying that he was.
No.
I think you were saying that.
He undermined the brand.
I'm just saying that he had that capacity, and he clearly has that capacity. It will be interesting to see what he does in the UK. I think he stood in for Graham Norton on Radio 2 on occasion and seems to have done quite well. So I'm not surprised that he's gone there. And like the rest of the panel, I mean, I think it's probably, from a career point of view, going to be the making of the man because he's now working in a market. It's also going to shake things up here significantly, I think, obviously. If no more nor in any other sector or in any other area of activity or employment, if people want to chase very, very big salaries, they're unlikely to be able to get them in a market the size of Ireland, no matter what sector they work within. And we're going to have to get a bit more realistic about things.
Some in local radio
Just 1 minute, you're nodding there, Rena.
Yeah, I mean,
so you've worked a lot in various commercial radio and in Sky as well. You've worked in the commercial end of things and then in a managerial level.
I mean, look, Brenda mentioned Terry Wogan. I actually mentioned it to Alan there on Friday. I firmly believe he will end up being on the Beeb. You know, he's a hugely talented broadcaster. And I think he'll reflect on this as one of the biggest mistakes that he ever made, not kind of, you know, putting the hand up and saying, yes, I was wrong, not to, you know, put the shoulder to the wheel and take the pain like my colleagues did. But having said that, you know, he has taken a big beating and he has been the symbol of discontent with RTE, rightly or wrongly. And he's come out the other side of that. But the duty of care to the taxpayer doesn't rest with the talent in RTE or with Ryan Tuberty. The duty of care was the management's responsibility. And if I was negotiating at that time as the manager, as I have done in the past, with people when they come to renegotiate their contracts, first of all, I would have appealed to Ryan's sense of his duty of care to his colleagues, to take the reduction just like everybody else did. If that didn't work, I would say, think about it from a PR perspective. This is going to be a pure disaster if it gets out that you are the only presenter that didn't take a hit like everybody else, for you and for the organisation.
Well, was that not why then the whole plan was concocted, that to make it look like you took a hit?
And to get around that, and that was very cynical. But then in the end, if it came down to it and there was still a refusal to take the reduction, I would say, well, OK, what's your leverage? At that time, I don't remember hearing in any of the newspapers that there was anybody else beating down Ryan's door to hire him. I don't think News Talk had an offer on the table. I don't think the Beeb had an offer on the table. And I don't even think that Virgin were at the table at that time. There was no leverage. I mean, it's standard. It's negotiation 101.
Yeah, no, and people will say, look, it has been proven now that, we don't know that there wasn't leverage. And secondly, it seems to have been proven that there is a market out there for him.
But it's also been proven that listenership wasn't dependent upon him being in the slot. It's gone up 13,000 since he vacated the slot. And look at, you know, when Pat Kenny left to go to News Talk, everybody predicted that lots of people would move the dial over to News Talk. Now he's doing very well there and his listenership has gone up and he's done well on News Talk. But like numbers on that mid-morning show that Claire Byrne is now doing, or that Sarah McInerney covered over a period of time, they haven't gone down, right?
And so Sean O'Rourke left.
Exactly. Like the idea that a particular presenter on their own will drive big, big numbers doesn't hold up. It doesn't hold
the
up.
The answer simply should have been no. It should have been no. You're not. You have to take the salary cut like everybody else.
But at this point, don't we surely need to move beyond? I don't mean this in a personal way, but beyond Ryan at this stage.
And that's exactly what we're going to do, actually, right? So in terms of, I suppose, Johnny, what's in the news today is the funding model is one of the stories. So you've picked the Mail on Sunday, revenue to collect TV licence fee. Now, the Sunday Independent seems to be saying that the minister backs ending the TV licence fee.
Yeah, and I think it's just an interesting from both papers, and the Mail is talking about, you know, the revenue collecting it as a method, you know, which would be stronger and, you know, might get around the evasion of the charge. But it would be a particularly difficult thing for government to bring in. So it's not one that I think government would be relishing bringing in. Meanwhile, over on the Independent, Hugh O'Connell has a piece where he says Catherine Martin is pushing to abolish the TV licence fee and replace it with direct taxpayer funding for RTE, a move that puts her on collision course with her coalition colleagues. Now, she's taking that in the report that was published in July 22 from the Future of the Media Commission, which recommended the government introduce a new public funding model derived from general tax revenue, just from the Exchequer. I think what you've got here is a problem now for the government. First part of this is that for years they didn't deal with what we all knew was a problem, which was that the licence fee couldn't continue in the model it was in the modern world. It needed reform. They didn't deal with that. It's been let run. Now they've hit a crisis point. You have a minister, and to be fair to Minister Martin, she has said that she's going to take the decision.
We will be the government to deal with this.
But the problem they've got now is, if you introduce, right, so even if you have the best idea in the world, so if you come up with a really good solution, you can see why the government don't want to lose an extra charge or tax or anything that you've out there, because then you have to bring it from general tax revenue. That's always more difficult. So if you have a charge in place, you don't want to lose it. But even if they get a really good idea, the problem now is if you introduce even a good idea at the wrong time, people may oppose it and you'll never get that idea back. You could argue at one stage that water charges had a good theory behind it in helping people to reduce their use of water. But because it was pushed at the wrong time and the public were so against it, it's become impossible to put back on the agenda. So the government have to be very careful here. This side
so
of
the
election.
So it's not the right time to go to people asking them for money for RTE, essentially?
I think Shane Ross had pointed out that RTE is essentially too big to fail and that the RTE knows the government has to fund it and has to fund it directly, at least for the next 2 years. There's probably going to be some direct funding until they can find a model that works and then eventually bring in that model. But that essentially the money's going to have to be there and it's going to have to be some form of direct funding anyway.
Rina, what's your view coming from the commercial sector on the funding issue?
Well, there was one line from Brian Carey's piece on the Hybrid Vision.
Sunday Times Business section.
Yeah, indeed. You know, where he points out the fact that RTE is dominant in the advertising market. And yet in all the other pieces on this big strategic plan that Kevin Backhurst has, it's all about job cuts, flogging land and restructuring of the production model. Nobody is talking about restructuring or reform of the commercial model in RTE. I mean, certainly in the independent broadcast sector, both in TV and radio, RTE would always have been considered the sleeping giant. You know, in my, you know, whatever, 15 years in radio, not once did I ever come face to face or toe to toe with an RTE salesperson, for instance, where, you know, it's all based on inbound sales. There's generally considered to be a little bit of kind of complacency about generating advertising revenue because there's a sugar daddy there just in case things don't go all that well. But
Would argue that RTE was much too commercially active and looking after clients much too well as well. So, you know, be that as it may. Colm, you picked that the Mail piece on the license fee.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's just that piece about when Johnny was saying about finding a model that will work. I mean, essentially, I think what you're talking about, Johnny, is a model that can work politically as opposed to practically. Yeah. Because the practical models are out there, right? They're out there in other countries, including other countries of similar size. They're out there in terms of endless reports that are being produced. It's about the failure of the political system to get to grips with this and to deal with it. And the consequence of that now is where we're at and the fact that 400 people in this institution are looking down the barrel of losing their jobs over the next little while and the impact that that's going to have on the organisation. I in no way envy Kevin Backhurst the job that he has ahead of him, not least because it's going to be incredibly challenging to manage that kind of change in a context where there isn't political support on the part of government or the political system to make the changes that are necessary to allow you to change the organisation in the way that you need to, which now means he has to embark on this. I mean, elements of the plan, I think, are very troubling, right? I mean, when they talk about the decentralisation of production, that sounds like a great idea, but it reminds me of Charlie McCreevy and the budget announcement about decentralisation, and we know how that went. You know,
yeah, but
shifting,
equally, there are great studios in Cork, and there are great people working in Cork. The Cork studio does brilliant stuff and major pieces. Everyone will always argue that
RTE needs to get out of Dublin a bit more, stop being so Dublin-centric.
I completely agree. But you don't create that kind of significant change in your operations or your culture in a moment of crisis. Crisis often drives it. But the problem
crisis is often the opportunity for change.
Indeed,
people
I agree.
Have been saying for years RTE needs to change in modern ways.
And I completely agree. The problem that Kevin Backhurst faces now is that he has to make all of those changes in a time where the changes to the funding model aren't being made and where it's going to be enormously disruptive, not just to the operations of the organisation, but to its output. How can it continue to function as a public service broadcaster really effectively, as a creative entity really effectively, at a time when it's going to be going through such turmoil internally and big decisions around its future funding have not been made? Like, that's the piece that the political system needs to get to grips with. If it wants RTE to reform, it needs to provide it with the certainty that's required to allow them to drive and deliver the reforms.
To an extent, that is what's happening now. Kevin Backhurst has very clearly said, we need the money for this plan to work. The government came out very quickly and said, we're giving you the money.
For 2 years.
So I guess we'll see what happens.
A chicken and egg situation that the government has clearly said, we need to see a change in corporate governance and in the culture within RTE before we can get the public support for the kind of funding you're talking about.
Yeah,
and okay. I'm not convinced, by the way, that there wouldn't be public support for a significant shift in funding. I also don't actually agree with Catherine Martin that moving to full Exchequer funding is necessarily a good idea, because I do think there needs to be a level of more accountability for the transfer of funding into a public service broadcaster than there is if it's direct
Exchequer
funding.
And you
do
want political influence over the station. That if it's in the direct funding, you get into that the whoever's in power has the power over direct state funding.
Like, there's obviously but some idea that it's ring-fenced or something, and that it's government-proof.
But we may have this stopgap kind of piece where government has to step in for a while until we've got a system that we feel the public are at a point where we can actually sell it to the public, and the public will go, yes, I'm willing to pay the charge.
Okay.
The risk now is they won't.
Few texts. Ryan did and does have to share some responsibility for the problems in RTE now. People do need to take personal responsibility. Rose says Michael Parkinson wasn't a, quote, serious interviewer. Neither was Terry Rogan, but they both did okay. There's a plethora of seriousness in the world. We need more light-heartedness today. Ryan is very talented. Best of luck to Tob, says another texter. Joe says, I wish Ryan well, but will never tune into him on the radio again. He should have paid back the money, in my view. And finally, a Cork listener. I always enjoyed listening to Ben Dunne, a larger-than-life character with a big heart and many words of wisdom. May he rest in peace. Okay, we'll take a break. Brenda Power, Johnny Fallon, Colin McGorman and Rena Maycock staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Brenda Power, Johnny Fallon, Colm O'Gorman and Rena Maycock still with us. And we turn now to the Middle East. Just a bit of the kind of news this morning is that the Washington Post reported overnight that Israel and Hamas are close to an agreement on a US brokered deal that would free dozens of women and children held hostage in Gaza in exchange for a five-day pause in fighting. The release, which they report could begin within the next several days, barring last-minute hitches, could lead to the first sustained pause in conflict in Gaza. Benjamin Netanyahu has responded saying that there is no deal as of now. But I know that deal's been kind of grinding away in the background there, but it does seem as if it could be a bit more imminent now. But we'll come back to our own papers. Colm O'Gorman, what jumped out for you today?
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing that always strikes me about this particular moment in this conflict is how almost impossible it's become to even talk about it. Mm-hmm. Right? It feels impossible to speak any objective truth about what's happening, not least because it's very hard to establish what's actually happening. There's a big piece in the Sunday Independent on page 20 that's covering some of the most recent developments. They cover, for instance, the airstrike on a UN school in a refugee camp in Gaza, where many, many dozens of women and children were killed. And then they in the next sentence, they talk about how Israel is getting ready for an onslaught against Hamas in the enclave south after subduing the north, which is an extraordinary way to describe what's been happening in Gaza over the last couple of weeks. Just a reminder to people, I live in County Wexford. The Gaza Strip is about 1/8 the size of the county that I live in. 1/8 the size of the county that I live in, and has a population of 2.3 million people. Wexford has a population of 163,000 people. It's one of the most densely populated places on the planet. And it's currently been subjected to, and this language is right, an onslaught by one of the most sophisticated militaries in the world on a population of that size that cannot leave and that cannot escape. They were told to leave the north. They're now being told they have to leave the south. It's 11,500 people have been killed in Gaza over the last little while. We talk about Northern Ireland. That's three times the total numbers killed in Northern Ireland over 30 years. The scale of what's happening is staggering. The barbarity of the Hamas attack on Israel is mind-bendingly horrific. There's when I say good coverage, it's an awful way to talk about it, right? But we're finally beginning to see, I think, some coverage of some of the human stories at the heart of all of this. There's a good interview with by Louise O'Callaghan with Thomas Hand, who's the father of Emily Hand, who's talking about just the horror that he's going through, not knowing where she is, not knowing if she's getting food or water, not knowing if she's being cared for. And, you know, we know Emily's name. We don't know the names of all of the children who are just dying in horrific circumstances in Gaza on a daily basis now. It's great to hear, finally, that there seems to be some advance on the release of hostages. The hostages
must be released. It's a horrific crime that they were taken in the first instance. And then, of course, there has to be a ceasefire. Now, when we say there has to be, will there be? Because it doesn't seem like there's significant international pressure to force one. And when I go back to that point about the
You're viscerally upset, are you?
Brendan, I have spent time in the last few weeks with people who have lost families and loved ones on both sides of this conflict in the last 3 weeks. I was at a conference that I hosted in Lisbon last week, and in the room were people who were having to check their phones on an ongoing basis because they didn't know whether their family members were alive or dead. I have extended family members who have lost people in Gaza. I have dear colleagues who have lost people in the Hamas attack on Israel on the 7th of November. It's horrific what's happening. And what's deeply, deeply concerning is that we've lost connection, not just with the humanity of those who have been killed and are being killed, but it seems to me that we're losing connection with our own humanity in the context of all of this. You know, the idea that the horrors that we're seeing unfolding in Gaza right now could be acceptable in 2023 is mind-bending. I mean, it's extraordinary. And there's the degree of othering that we're seeing. Now, there's a long history of that in that conflict. I mean, in my role with Amnesty, my first ever meeting with an ambassador in that role was with an Israeli ambassador. Those were always really, really difficult meetings because Israel is very, very clear that attaches different moral values to Palestinians' lives lost in this conflict than it does to Israeli lives lost.
Okay,
they say that publicly.
But Hamas attaches very different values.
Exactly.
That was exactly
the next thing that was going to. Yeah. You didn't need to do the balance piece. Okay. I was going to say that next, straight out of my mouth. Hamas.
But it's not the balance. It's just
the
truth,
but it's true. Like, yeah. I mean, Hamas's attack on and the barbarity of that attack on Israel, clearly demonstrates that they have. They don't recognise in any way the humanity of the people that they target.
And in fairness, but this, for their own people as well.
But this
there have been protests in Palestine, in Gaza, over the last 5 years against Hamas.
Just let Brenda talk for a minute now.
But got zero attention here. As recently as last July, the people of Gaza took to the street with banners saying, "Let us live." They are being oppressed by Hamas, and there is no question but that Hamas doesn't give a toss about their lives either.
And I don't disagree with that point at all. I used to work for an organisation for 15 years that routinely investigated and highlighted and called out grave human rights
Amnesty
violations by Hamas
for
Amnesty in Gaza. And therein lies the problem. We have 2.3 million people who are trapped in, I think what David Cameron, who's back in the news again, once called an open-air prison that's been created by Israel, who are then left to their own devices under the rule of an organisation like Hamas without any access to basic rights, to any kind of basic rights. And where now they're being blamed for the fact that Hamas are in control of Gaza, as if somehow they got to make that decision. The last election in Gaza was in about 2006.
And much of
what happens in that space has been orchestrated by major world powers. Like the fact that Hamas are in power in Gaza is not purely down to the decisions of people in Gaza. Much of this was orchestrated and engineered by global political powers who wanted to divide, who wanted to undermine Fatah and the Palestinian Authority of the time as part of a political strategy.
Yeah, come out and say it. Netanyahu, this was the strategy as far as we can see. And the release of those 1,000 prisoners in return for the one Israeli soldier, we now learn that the mastermind of the attacks was potentially one of those guys that Netanyahu decided to release back into Gaza. Brenda, you wanted to say something?
Yeah,
else
no,
there?
I was just in respect of Hamas's, you know, behaviour throughout this, and I completely agree that it is astonishing, as you say, Colm, that we have come to almost accept this as a daily news item. The loss of life in Gaza, it is astonishing, and the scenes in the papers today, you know, hard to look at, but the extent to which Hamas intended this to happen to their own people is quite astonishing. I saw an interview during the week with one Hamas leader, and he was being asked about this network of underground tunnels that allegedly they have used international aid to Gaza to build and construct to the highest level of sophistication. Could their citizens have access to them? And he said, no, those are for us. So these are people who do not care about the Gazans either. And I think the biggest mistake that Netanyahu made of a lot of mistakes, but in response to this attack, was to do exactly what he did, exactly what Hamas wanted him to do, go in bald-headed the next day and start slaughtering civilians.
You know, Hamas are responsible for what Hamas did, and what they did is, and what they do is objectionable and horrific, and they need to be held to account for that. And in the midst of all of this, we have to acknowledge that Israel's response to that is something that Israel needs to be responsible for.
Okay.
And it's, I mean, that's the great thing about international law, if it's properly applied. It's an objective measure through which people are held accountable for their own actions. And they can't talk, they can't say, but the other fella did.
But,
right, there are laws that apply.
How much different would this have played out had Netanyahu said, okay, we're not going to respond for the moment, we're going to solidify our defences, we're going to bury our dead, and we're going to make sure for the next month, year, that the world hears the story of every one of those people who was killed in that situation. And then the weight of international opinion would be in their favour and would be against them.
But everybody knew what Netanyahu was going to do, and everybody knew that the sympathy would be gone.
And 11,500 people are dead as a consequence, and men, women and children are facing horrors. I mean, look at the report from the World Health Organization that visited the hospital in Gaza yesterday, where it was just very, very clear about the situation there. You know, that it described it as desperate and a death scene, that it's just, this is a hospital that is now just overtaken by death.
And yet there's evidence, according to this piece in the Sunday Times, I think it's on page 10, to the extent that there is evidence that Hamas were ensconced in Al-Shifa Hospital.
Oh, that's deeply, deeply disputed on lots and lots of levels. For instance, they haven't found
evidence.
The only underground bunker that's been found, as I understand it, is one that was built under the hospital by Israel as an underground operating theatre.
Yeah.
They dug up a tunnel outside it, outside the hospital. But as you said quite rightly, Hamas have tunnels running everywhere across Gaza. So dig anywhere in Gaza, you're going to find a tunnel. The suggestion that they found large numbers of weapons or significant numbers of fighters, I think that's a nonsense.
Well, like they say, though, that Hamas's operations would be pretty mobile. So they would be able to... Anyway.
But then they either did or didn't find it.
But who do you believe?
Look, I honestly think you're both on the same side of this. I don't think it needs to be a two sides kind of thing. I think everybody's reaction is roughly the same. And I think, in a way, somebody said both sides of this are right, and they're both wrong in equal measure.
And 2.3 million people in Gaza need to be the focus of our attention right now, because they are the only population of people who are not just under imminent threat, but who are right now being killed in an onslaught by one of the most significant militaries in the world. There has to be a ceasefire, and the hostages have to be released, and we have to stay doggedly focused on that point.
And equally, we have to stay doggedly focused on the fact that the people in Israel, a lot of them, there's gradients of opinion across their column, but you would agree that they feel they are under existential threat as well from an organisation that wants to wipe them out.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that is Hamas's objective.
And they have an absolute right. And not only do they have a right, but the state has an obligation to protect its citizens from that kind of attack.
And eventually,
but within the rule of international law,
when,
it must do
when
so.
Those peace talks happen, you know, we all know that eventually is where it goes to. Unfortunately, it's not quick, but it's going to happen. You just think that the world should be looking on and saying, can we advance that now before more people die
unnecessarily?
And I think
that clamour is becoming more and more and more. Okay, thank you very much to my panel today. Brenda Power, columnist with the Irish Daily Mail and Sunday Times. Johnny Fallon, Strategy Director of Carr Communications. Colm O'Gorman, human rights campaigner. And Rena Maycock, Chief Executive of Kilter Child Protection Software and former Chief Executive of iRadio.